This is day six of this January 2014 Rohatsu 7-day session. We'll return to the teachings of Korean Zen master Kusan Sunim from reading from the book called The Way of Korean Zen, edited by Stephen Batchelor. Read a few more pages and try to avoid reading things that he's already said several times that we've read. We're still reading from the winter retreat, discourses from a winter retreat. Throughout beginningless eons, the way has been obscured by the great weight and depth of defilements. Defilements, it took me a while in my Zen career to appreciate this word. I don't know if other people have the same trouble with it sounding awfully icky. But it's just a general word for maybe afflictions. Yeah, that's a good Buddhist word, afflictions. All of the stuff that hold us back, all of the things that cause us misery in our relations with other people and our ideas, our neuroses. I'm going to switch to afflictions. Exactly how heavy and deep are these afflictions? They are as heavy as the earth and as deep as the ocean. Afflictions are actually the habitual tendencies you have acquired since beginningless time. Since they are so deeply ingrained within you and weigh you down so greatly, how can you not see the need to practice with the utmost diligence? The afflictions are like clouds covering the sun. Although the sun shines brightly behind the clouds, its brightness cannot be seen. Only when the clouds disperse will its brilliance be clearly apparent. Now, if you really want to unearth a precious gem from the mud and stones of afflictions, you should think of how snow and ice harden and melt. Recently, there has been much snow here. Now it is packed and hardened on the ground and will not melt very quickly. Just look. The snow is delivering an unsurpassable discourse on the Dharma. For to dissolve the afflictions and discover your true nature is similar to the melting of this snow. In order for it to melt, it must be exposed to the sun. Thereupon it turns into water, which you can then use for drinking, washing, and so forth. Imagine how long it would take to melt if it were only exposed to the sun for one day and then allowed to harden again over the following 10 cold days. It is similar when you try to practice meditation. If you practice hard for one day but then relax and enjoy yourselves during the next 10 days, how will the hardened crust of the afflictions ever melt? Again, this hammering away at the need to make the practice continuous. It's very difficult to do that. And the mind is unsteady. We go through a period of good concentration, and then our concentration sags. We get distracted. We get discouraged because the concentration is as good, and then eventually we work our way back to good concentration, only to repeat the cycle again. This is where the will is so important, to really be clear about your intention. What is it you want? We are up against an awfully strong enemy. And this sense of fighting an enemy can be used up to a point. He also says you must hold on to the koan with the same degree of energy as you would have upon meeting an enemy after 10,000 years and being resolute on taking revenge. When I skipped this when I first came across it a couple days ago, because I think these martial metaphors, for some people at certain times, can not be helpful. They are already perhaps seeing the koan as an enemy, but it's not the koan that's the enemy. It's the mind and the ego and its dominance in the mind and the way it we get whipped around by it. And then I reflected back to a certain period when I really got a lot of traction just by getting that sense of just kind of the fury of being the bitch of this mind for so long. and how it can really rouse one's energy. They have in either Korean Zen or Chinese Zen, they have this term, great angry determination. It's getting fed up with always coming out on the losing end of this mind of separation, this delusive mind of ego. It can be used, that kind of anger. It's a kind of a pure and clean anger at all of these forces that have sat on us for so long and wanting to get out from under them. You must hold on to the koan with the same degree of energy as you would have upon meeting an enemy after 10,000 years and being resolute on taking revenge. 10,000 years is nothing compared to how long we have been subjugated by this mind. And he develops that. Throughout beginningless eons, you have been transmigrating through the suffering ocean of birth and death. Now, for one time, the mass of questioning is clear, and awakening is very close by. It is as though it were screened off by a single sheet of white paper. Soon the moment will arrive when you can take revenge on birth and death through achieving liberation from them. Continues, even in the midst of the utmost quiescence, you should never let the koan fade. For if at such times it remains bright and vivid, then great awakening will draw nearer. This is this is a really a critical point when one feels suddenly free of thoughts and is sailing in this wonderful spaciousness and silence and stillness. And but one then at such times it can be easy to think, okay, right, who needs the koan? I'm there. I'm it this is wonderful. But that will pass. That state of ease and stillness and clarity, it will pass unless there is a breakthrough. And that means you've got to get the koan back in the mind, even though it feels unsavory. The koan is, you know, you've learned that the koan just brings in this discordant element by its nature, this element of doubt, this kind of a tension, struggle. Yeah, don't abandon it. You abandon that, and then you're just at the mercy of the winds of change. Furthermore, the meditator should now consider the koan as his very life. When coming, the koan should be coming. When going, the koan should be going. While eating, the koan should be eating. And even while defecating, it should be the koan that defecates. If you practice in such a way, then great awakening will certainly be closer. And he says, I would like to comment upon the following well-known proverb. In the utmost softness lies the greatest strength. In the utmost harmony, the sublimest joy. In the utmost gentleness, the noblest virtue. And in the utmost meekness, the highest felicity. Only with the utmost patience does one become a sage. And then he comments, it is possible that someone might appear on the outside to be rather simple and even foolish. He may seem to have no courage, to be overly compliant and slow-witted. However, inside he may be wielding a mighty sword. Similarly, when confronting circumstances, on the outside you should appear to deal with them softly and compliantly, yet inside your mind should be as sharp as a mighty sword. A person who can act in such a way has truly built up a sound practice. Well, we commented earlier in the session about this ideal in Zen of being pliant and flexible and gentle on the outside and having this iron core. This is generally an Asian ideal that we in our culture don't seem to share that, where so much is about self-promotion and who can talk loudest and be most belligerent. It's a quality in Asia that deceives Westerners so often. They see these qualities of softness and pliancy and don't understand that is cultivated through in a culture that prizes harmony as possibly the highest virtue, getting along, which is in many ways just the very opposite of our adversarial culture. Those are much older cultures, of course. They've learned, they've spent centuries, millennia in wars, and they've learned that it doesn't work to set yourself up assert yourself every chance you get, quarreling, arguing, seeing who can win. It's a sign of immaturity in our culture that these are such our prized values. But I'll let him say more. Likewise, you should try to be harmonious. You should learn to like and get on well with one another and to do things for other people instead of yourself. But if you behave in a way that is contrary to the well-being and interests of others, then you will only create conflict. He continues, it is important to be gentle and not to go against the wishes of others. Even go out of your way to be helpful to other people. In this way, you will amass the noblest of virtues. Meekness is another quality that should be cultivated. Instead of forcing yourselves on others, you should learn to flexibly adapt yourselves to their needs. You should listen well to what they say and offer to help them in whatever work they are doing. In this way, you will find contentment and happiness, and give it as well, I would say. Finally, you must learn to be patient. You need to be able to forbear hardships, endure difficulties, and undertake what is arduous. While practicing, you are liable to encounter difficult periods. It is important not to give up at such times, but to bear through them diligently. In this way, the strength of forbearance will grow within you, and in the end, you will become accomplished sages. Such people are able to sit on the lion throne and utter a lion's roar for the welfare of all beings. These qualities that he's talking about, patience, meekness, harmony, flexibility, these are all qualities that we develop through practice, willy-nilly. The longer we practice, the more we develop them without even trying. They are just the fruits of Zen practice. It depends on where you started out. You can have very, very belligerent and loud people who after 5 or 10 years may not be, you know, the model of pliancy and patience and meekness and so forth. But it's always in that direction that we go, because those are qualities of the Tao, the way. These are qualities of our nature. Practice is just stripping off the accretions that go against these things, that get in the way of these things, that obstruct them. He continues, there are many people who, after persevering in their practice for a while, don't feel that they are progressing. They then give up in despair and start to think about practicing something else. In this way, they succumb to delusive thinking and laziness. Such an attitude is self-destructive. For if you were sure of being reborn as a human being, then it would not matter so much if you wasted this one life in idly enjoying yourselves. But actually, there is no certainty as to what sort of rebirth is awaiting you. Some people believe that death is final and there is no further life after it. Which, by the way, is a belief. Just as rebirth is a belief, so is the idea that there's nothing after death, because no one knows for sure. We have this this majestic tradition of hundreds of years in which rebirth is taken for granted. We have the fact that some half the world, possibly more than half the world, if you consider India and China, Japan and Korea and all, more than half the world that takes for granted rebirth. But because we have no evidence or very little rock hard evidence, people who are generally deceived by their senses, deceived by appearances, see no evidence and then think otherwise. It doesn't matter in terms of Zen practice. It really doesn't. The emphasis in Zen is now. How present are you? How mindful are you and of using this precious life? This one, never mind future and past. Such persons, again referring to those who believe that death is final, such persons are regarded as having fallen into the extreme view of nihilism. In other words, nothing. There's nothing at all after death. Then there are others who are unconcerned about the nature of their subsequent rebirths. They think that now one should just enjoy this life, and if one is then reborn in hell or as an animal, what does it really matter? They believe that since the mind is eternal, one will continue to receive numerous bodies. What reason is there to be concerned about any particular rebirth? People who think in this way fall into the extreme view of eternalism. It is important to free yourselves from these two extremes of nihilism and eternalism. This is one of the axes by which the phrase the middle way can be interpreted. The middle way is a designation of Buddhism in general. It can mean the middle way between self-indulgence and self-punishment. It can also mean this, the middle way between the idea of no self and the idea of a enduring permanent self. The Buddha never said there's absolutely no self, because we know that it's a word that has its use to describe a certain continuity, a relative permanence to our character and personality and physical appearance. But it's not the same as saying that there is any kind of absolutely permanent, unchanging self. And yet that's the basic assumption by most people, is that there is someone who moves through time unchanged. An ego. And this can really wreak havoc in one's practice. If you buy into this idea that there's some person, unchanging person, who has a certain kind of character and certain weaknesses, and then all you can do is struggle in vain against these tendencies, that's absolutely contrary to the way things are. There is no one. There is nothing permanent. We can endlessly work and rework ourselves. We are not stuck with these afflictions. He continues, after practicing meditation for some time, you will experience entering the door of emptiness. This is what I was talking about a little while ago, this state of clarity and silence and still. Subsequently, you have to take one further step off the 100-foot pole. Only then will you be able to pierce through the barrier of the patriarchs. When one thought arises, all the 10,000 forms of the universe come into being. And when one thought ceases, they all return to quiescent emptiness, and the joy of nirvana is experienced. He continues taking away all of our rationalizations here. It is still possible that even after repeated hard practice, it may seem that no progress is being made. At such times, the thought may occur that you are simply not suited for such an arduous and difficult task. Such a practice of meditation may be suitable for those who have already had a great deal of experience in the past, but not for a beginner like oneself. But to entertain such thoughts is to crush the seed of Buddhahood. It's like digging a hell for yourself. To reject this task simply because it seems difficult will only cause you to undergo further suffering wherever you are. The path ahead of you will grow dim, and you will be destined to endless days of darkness. In such a state, how will you ever be able to free yourself from birth and death? So what kept me going in those early years was just the question, okay, this is awfully difficult. This is just awful. And I'm awful at it. But what's the alternative? What's the alternative? To give up? Just go back to no practice and just let these afflictions just run roughshod over one's life and wreaking havoc here and there? What's the alternative? We can't turn back. We have found the way through. We have found the way. However long it takes, however difficult it is, we have to continue. This mind of stepping back and measuring one's progress, looking ahead and saying, "Oh my God, this will take forever." That's the problem. That's the problem. Separating oneself. And then making this big melodrama about it. What hope is there for me? This is where Manjushri's sword has to be brandished and wielded. Cut it out. It's childish. We got a lot of work to do. There's no time for self-pity and catastrophizing and thinking this is such a hopeless kind of Sisyphean kind of job. He continues, no matter how difficult it may seem at times, if you continue uninterruptedly to exert yourselves, your meditation will eventually mature. And it will. And it will. It already has. For people who are not complete beginners, they've already seen how much easier it gets. It's only by stepping back and looking at it like in that kind of way and getting all tangled up in ideas of time that it seems so bleak. One is already on the way. The defilements you have accumulated will gradually disappear and your wandering thoughts will lessen. In this way, progress will become visible. As long as you maintain a sustained effort, why should you not finally awaken? This is the point. As long as you maintain a sustained effort, why shouldn't you awaken? Because we are already enlightened in our true nature. There's no place we have to go. There's nothing we have to get. We just have to persevere. The Buddhas and the patriarchs of the past were ordinary human beings like yourselves. It was only through their determination that they were able to endure beyond strength what was hard to endure, and thus succeeded in accomplishing the difficult task of awakening. The method of practice has not changed. It is the same now as it was then. This is, you know, we hear these spectacular stories of the masters and their enlightenment experiences, and it's easy to forget that they weren't always that way. I mean, that's okay. That's why we read stories of their trials and tribulations early in their practice. But it's still, one can forget it. Remember Kusan earlier in Sashin, our reading, him saying, "I realized then that this matter is not as easy as cooling porridge by pouring cold water over it." And then this is a short talk. It begins with some italicized passage. I'm sorry, I didn't do my homework. I don't know what that means. We'll just read it. When you have to walk somewhere on a dark night, it is very difficult to clearly see the path ahead of you. You do not know whether the way will consist of mountains, deep gullies, swamps, thorny forests, or rock-covered ground. That's the end of that passage. And then these are definitely his words, if the others weren't. One by one, you may have to encounter and traverse each of these difficult terrains. But if you don't stop and continue walking carefully throughout the night, eventually the dim light of dawn will appear in the east and gradually become brighter. As the sun rises, the path ahead will become clearer and clearer, and the difficult passages will become easier to traverse. It is similar when practicing meditation. Whatever difficulties you face at the beginning, you should learn to endure them all. Whether you are beset by wandering thoughts, overcome with drowsiness, or aggravated by pain in your legs or back, you should never allow them to distract you from the meditation. If you continuously persevere, then suddenly your firm hold on the koan will appear before you as a wide and boundless path. Being able to see the path distinctly, you should make the firm resolve to swiftly advance. Now, while keeping a firm hold on the koan, you can confidently allow the mind to be as it is. In due time, your original nature will shine forth as brilliantly as the rising sun. Here's another passage. When an ordinary person begins to practice meditation, he may feel that there is something to be cultivated and something to be realized. But should he experience a great awakening, he would then understand that there is really nothing to be cultivated and nothing to be realized. This is so because there is nothing that can affect our true nature. The accomplished sage is not endowed with more of it, and the ordinary person is not endowed with less of it. The only difference lies in the fact that the sage has awakened to his true nature, whereas the ordinary person remains ignorant of it. In the Avatamsaka Sutra, it is stated, "He who wishes to comprehend the state of Buddhahood should purify his mind until it becomes like empty space." What does it mean to purify the mind until it becomes like empty space? It means to reach a point where it is no longer stained by afflictions. The mind is similar to empty space. Depending on the changing conditions, space may be filled with clouds, wind may blow through it, rain and snow may fall through it, the sun or moon may shine within it, or it may be enveloped in darkness. However, none of these things actually affect the nature of space itself. During a rainstorm, it does not get wet. Neither clouds, wind, moonlight, nor darkness affect the way it is. It can never be impeded or obstructed by anything. The mind truly resembles empty space when it is emptied of all delusive thinking. At this time, all thoughts of good or bad, right or wrong, this or that, disappear from the mind. But what must be done in order for all such concepts to disappear? First, you must search for the mind through meditation. By exerting much effort, the root of questioning will become firmly established in the mind. When this questioning is very stable, then in one moment everything will dissolve and vanish. At this time, you will realize that the universe that you previously imagined to exist, in fact, does not. Although I could tell you that the universe does not really exist, it would be hard for you to really believe this. While seeming to exist, it does not actually exist. Only when you awaken will you realize this to be the case. It is not something you can understand through words and letters. For this is the secret of the Buddhas and the patriarchs. Even though the universe seems real, in fact, it is not. One of the favorite analogies, modern analogies, you won't find in any sutra, is that of a movie. The film can take on the appearance of reality there on the screen. I heard that when moving pictures were introduced in some towns in Italy, the peasants who watched it got extremely upset and tried to bust into the screen. But we know that to use the analogy of the strip of film, it's just a lot of separate frames that, because of the rapidity and the fluidity of the movement, give the appearance of reality. When practicing meditation, there are times when it goes well and times when it goes badly. Sometimes it is as smooth as pushing a boat over ice. But you should not then give rise to thoughts of joy. In that way, you would be captured by the Mara of joy, the demon of joy. This is another Buddhist, or at least a Zen phrase, the demon of joy, where you allow yourself to get all excited by a passing feeling of joy and how it can take you far afield. But he comments, "At other times, it is as difficult as trying to pull an ox into a well." I think of someone who said, "Cats are different from dogs. You can't get 8 cats to pull a sled." So to repeat, at other times it is difficult as trying to pull an ox into a well, but then there is no need to give rise to thoughts of sadness or failure, for in that way you would become a prisoner of the Mara of sadness and failure. In other words, when you're just engaged with this difficult task, then you're not susceptible to what can happen when you give way to joy and feelings of despair. At other times you may suffer from headaches, dimness of vision, or a feeling as though your teeth were falling out. That must be a Korean makyo. I've heard hundreds of them in Doksan, but I haven't heard of that one. But there's still time. Sometimes when you are walking, it might seem as though on a calm day the wind is blowing, or that the earth is shaking, when in fact it is not. At such times, do not succumb to feelings of fear or anxiety. Do not lose your hold on the koan. Such things are only temporary states of mind produced by tensions in the body. You will never achieve anything if at these times you cease to meditate on the koan. We'll say that at this stage of Sesshin, this late stage of Sesshin, that Makyo can get more, they can get stronger, they can get more exotic, and therefore more problematic. Can be a kind of, you can consider these Makyo kind of a final crucible test of your faith in the practice as something that will take you through all of it. We have the great, great classic story of the Mara's assault on Shakyamuni when he was sitting beneath the Bodhi tree, bringing all of his army of demons and his murderous war elephant is the one of the ways it's described. As he was sitting and drawing nearer and nearer to awakening, the ego senses that its dominance in the mind is threatened, its throne is under attack, and then at such a time, like they say, a wild animal, a beast, will fight most ferociously when it's cornered, and this is the effect that it's just sometimes when we're closest that the obstructions become most formidable, most daunting. And that's the test of faith, not to get be deceived by these temporary states of mind, body-mind states. It's both. No, that's enough. Let's stop now and recite the four vows.